this week for the colloquium, we have perimeter's own Kendrick Smith. Let me give you some of Kendrick's biography. He did his PhD at the University of Chicago, postdocs at University of Cambridge and Princeton. He joined the PI faculty in 2012, I believe. So Kendrick is a cosmologist who specializes in data analysis. He's been part of a lot of large collaborations like the Planck satellite, WMAP. He was part of the WMAP team when they won the Gruber Cosmology Prize. And more recently, he's been part of the CHIME collaboration, which is what he's going to tell us about today.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for coming. So by background, I'm mainly a CMB cosmologist and have worked on things like this. In particular, I'm currently working on KSD cosmology with some people in the audience. But today, for the colloquium, I decided to talk about this project, the CHIME telescope, because it's an exceptionally interesting and fun to talk about project. For the last couple of years, I've been pretending to be a radio astronomer, helping to build this telescope in Penticton, British Columbia. By building, I really mean building algorithms and software. But as you'll see, CHIME is mainly a software telescope, and I'll explain what I mean by that. So if you are curious about anything in these slides, please feel free to chat with me afterwards. So I'd like to start by acknowledging my collaborators on CHIME. CHIME is a collaboration of about 100 people with large groups at these four institutions and smaller groups at these five institutions, including Perimeter. I'll mainly emphasize things that were done at PI, so the most of the work that I'll describe was done by this team of superheroes. I would say that CHIME is a flagship project for Canadian astrophysics. It's the first new Canadian research telescope in something like 40 or 50 years. Here's some mostly Canadian press from our formal first light in September. Just between you and me, for a software telescope, first light means that instead of spending most of your time running cables, you're spending most of your time debugging software. So we're still in sort of an engineering and commissioning stage, but a late stage. I want to start by just talking about the concept, the idea behind CHIME, which is new and very interesting. Let me compare CHIME, which is four cylinders sitting on the ground with no moving parts. In each of these cylinders, there's a feed line with 256 antennas hanging on the underside so that they look down at the reflector. With a traditional radio telescope, which would be one antenna or maybe a few antennas suspended in front of a big dish. The traditional radio telescope focuses by optical path delay. The optics have been constructed so that if a bundle of rays comes in from the correct direction, all of these paths have the same length and the rays interfere constructively. Now, I want you to imagine getting rid of the dish and simulating it in software. What I mean by that is that you replace the dish by an array of antennas, one antenna per square wavelength, digitize the electric field at each of those locations, and then add the digital time streams together with the correct delays to mimic the focusing effect of the dish. This is what you would call a phased array interferometer. Now, if you have enough computing power, you can do something really interesting. Because digital time streams may be copied freely, you can take two copies of the time streams and combine them with two different sets of delays to have the effective statistical power of two telescopes looking in slightly different directions. And if you do this n times, you are equivalent to n telescopes looking in slightly different directions, but of course your computing costs go up by a factor of n. CHIME is sort of the extreme case of this idea. We have 1,024 antennas and enough computing power to form all 1,024 independent beams on the sky in real time. So this might seem like it's too good to be true, but it is true that this instrument, for most purposes, has the raw statistical power of 1,024 telescopes of the same collecting area, 80 meters aside, all pointing in slightly different directions, observing all the time. Here are some cartoons to give a better sense for how CHIME observes. The CHIME design is a compromise between optical and software focusing. The cylinder is focused in one direction and unfocused in the other, so the so-called primary beam, or the sky pattern that any single antenna in the system would see, is a narrow stripe on the sky. By software beamforming, as previously described, we can focus on any one of 1,024 formed beams in that primary beam. CHIME has no moving parts. It just sits on the ground. But as the sky rotates, this pattern of primary and formed beams sweeps out the whole sky, or the whole northern sky. And Every day, our primary science product is an image of the northern sky with angular resolution of about 0.3 degrees in radio frequency range from 400 to 800 megahertz. That frequency range was originally chosen to do cosmology in this redshift range. But as sort of a lucky coincidence, that happens to be a very interesting frequency range for a lot of other things like pulsar astrophysics or fast radio burst astrophysics. Now let me show you the table that got me so interested in this project a couple of years ago. From everything that I've said so far, you would infer that the statistical power of a radio telescope is proportional to the product of its collecting area times the number of beams. The collecting area determines the sensitivity per beam, and then there's some number of beams that you can afford to compute, and their product is called the mapping speed, omitting some order one factors like system temperatures, bandwidths, and so on, which are important in detailed forecasts. But so the slide is a little too simple, but it's qualitatively correct. And here is Chaim compared to some famous radio telescopes. And in some arbitrary units, which are not what's actually used, Chaim is as good or better as the other telescopes on the list, including FAST. But let's think about how ridiculous that is. Here are FAST and Chaim compared to scale. FAST is the 500-meter radio telescope in northern China, which is one of the biggest and most ambitious projects in astronomy. And Chaim is this little grassroots effort that a relatively small number of people are putting together for 1% of the budget in British Columbia. Can it really be true that these telescopes have comparable statistical power? That seems too good to be true. It seems like there would have to be something wrong with it. But then this calculation seems too simple to be wrong. So what's going on? There is actually a catch that I'll tell you about in a few minutes. But first, I want to show you the forecasts and scientific goals of the project. So let's start with cosmology. This is mainly what I joined Chaim to do. Radio telescopes can do cosmology or attempt to do cosmology.
Can I just ask, just to make sure I understood. So the basic idea is that the telescope focuses on one point, so you catch one signal at a time. But with Chaim, signals coming from different directions go to different sensors, and therefore you catch much more information.
That's right. You can observe more. Because you focus.
Directions go to different places. They don't go to the same focal point.
That's basically right. Yeah. With a telescope, with a single dish telescope like this, you could maybe have order 10 points in the focal plane that are in focus. So you could maybe get 10 beams. In Chaim, because we do the focus, we just collect the radiation over a large area and do the focusing in software, we can have many more beams. So radio telescopes can do cosmology via the 21-centimeter spectral line in neutral hydrogen. If you consider a single dish pointing along a single line of sight, in this cartoon, there's a galaxy at redshift 1. Hydrogen emits at a rest wavelength of 1420 megahertz. So that redshifts to 710 megahertz. And there's another galaxy at redshift 2, so you get another bump at 470 megahertz. And so generally, in this 1D example, the spectrum can be viewed as a noisy 1D spatial map of the neutral hydrogen density along the line of sight, with the frequency playing the role of the radial coordinate. And Chaim takes a spectrum for every angular location on the sky, so we get a 3D map with two angular coordinates and one radial coordinate done by frequency of the neutral hydrogen density. Chaim does not have the angular resolution to resolve individual galaxies, as the previous cartoon would suggest. But so each of these hot and cold spots would correspond to the average density or the average emission of many galaxies in the volume element. But this is a noisy three-dimensional map of the cosmological density field of the density field on cosmological scales, in the same sense that when we measure the CMB, that's a noisy map of fluctuations in the universe on cosmological scales. And if I were to compare these two ways of doing cosmology, the CMB has been an enormous historical success story. And most of our information about cosmology still comes from the CMB. The problem with it is that we're running out of modes. We've measured almost all of the modes in this map and the temperature. And we can go further in polarization, but in the not too distant future, we're just going to run out of modes to measure in the CMB. In contrast, 21 centimeter cosmology, I would say it's very high risk, high reward, in that it's a much more difficult signal to measure. The signal itself is weak. The 21 centimeter emission line is pretty weak. And it's also difficult to disentangle from things, other signals like galactic foregrounds or radio point sources. But if it can be measured, so far this has barely been detected. But if it can be measured well, then there's potentially much more information here than here. And that's really true just because of mode counting. There's just way more modes in 3D than there are in 2D. So from a very futuristic point of view, this may ultimately be the best way of doing cosmology. But 21 centimeter cosmology is still a field that's in its infancy. So I thought this was really interesting.
Ask a question. Why do you have this lower limit in the redshift?
Why from redshift 0.8 to 2.5? That is set by a frequency range, 400 to 800 megahertz, and we could have chosen a different range. The reason why we chose that one, it's not a fundamental limitation, it's a choice in time. The reason that we chose that redshift range, let me just go to the next slide. So one thing, you can do a lot of things with this neutral hydrogen map, but the easiest thing to do, still hard, but the easiest, is to measure the expansion history of the universe using the baryon acoustic oscillation statistical feature and the correlation function. This plot compares our constraints to current constraints from galaxy surveys. CHIME's redshift range, to answer your question, is chosen to cover the so-called redshift desert, where the galaxies are starting to run out. It's hard to observe galaxies above a redshift of around 1. But the Lyman Alpha Forest from quasars at higher redshift hasn't started yet. This redshift range is not well covered by existing data sets. You free?
I also have a simple question. Can you go back?
Yeah.
So I don't understand this comparison between what you can do with CMB and which CHAM can measure. I mean, this CMB refers to not just 2D, but it's going much back in the past, right?
There are certainly some differences. This red light comes from redshift 1000, and this is coming from this was emitted much more recently.
But
what we measure is a 2D field here.
Right. But on thought that the top one is referring to actual things that are now there. I mean, it's not coming from the Big Bang, right?
That's right. So there's more processing. There are a lot of details.
Same objects in the first place. You're not visualizing the same objects, astrophysical.
That's right. The details of the physics that process the initial conditions into the CMB versus the neutral hydrogen density are very different.
Okay.
And that does matter when you work out in detail which parameters you can constrain well.
Right, but I'm saying that these are windows to different phenomena or different physics.
That is true. If you were to look at parameter constraints in detail, it would be true, for example, that there are parameter degeneracies in the CMB that are broken by this map or vice versa. So what I'm saying here is really quite simplified.
But what are you trying to look at when you use this?
So a concrete example would be constraining neutrino mass. That's a parameter as you vary the neutrino mass, the power spectrum of these maps changes. So there's some sensitivity to neutrino mass, but there's a lot of processing and computing that you have to do that's hidden in the details of that statement. But as a general qualitative statement, it's correct to say that there's more, potentially more sensitivity here for most cosmological parameters, just because there are more modes.
Maybe you're going to get to this soon, but I'm curious about whether you have anything to say about this recent EDGES result, or whether the CHIME could. I understand that it's a different frequency range, but I'm curious.
EDGES is doing something quite different. CHIME is trying to measure the anisotropy. Whereas EDGES is measuring the mean spectrum of the sky as a function of frequency and looking for a predicted dip around reionization. Not only are they at different redshifts, but they're actually measuring something quite different. I have a lot to say about EDGES, but let me say it after the talk. Radio astronomy is a big subject, and CHIME is interesting for things other than cosmology. In particular, fast radio bursts are a very interesting recent topic. Very occasionally, a bright, highly dispersed pulse of radio waves is observed. Dispersed means that the arrival time depends on frequency channel in a way which is proportional to frequency to the -2. That is the dispersion relation that you get when a wave propagates through a thin, cold, unmagnetized plasma of free electrons, suggesting a high electron column density between us and the event, possibly because the FRBs are extremely bright objects at cosmological distances. These were a surprise, and the physics is not understood even after about 10 years of thinking about it. I can't really do justice to the huge variety of models that have been proposed in the literature. I just put a few abstracts up as titles up as eye candy. And this has grown to become one of the most interesting puzzles in observational astrophysics. Only 30 of these events have been observed since their initial discovery in 2007, so we're still sort of learning new things from individual detections, and we certainly don't have enough events to really do statistics yet. The CHIME forecasted event rate is, I put dot, dot, dot for dramatic effect, 10 per day. So when we start the search, it should be a total game changer, and we can really potentially discover a lot about these mysterious objects.
How do you get this number 10 if you don't know what's causing the?
That's just an empirical event rate. They're with 30 events, and you know roughly how much observing time has been performed by different telescopes. We know roughly what the event rate is empirically, but we can't predict it. There's some uncertainty in this number because most of the detections are at 1.4 gigahertz, and you have to extrapolate down in frequency. So this is uncertain by about, this event rate is actually uncertain by like a factor of 10. But this is sort of a neutral guess. By like a factor of 10.
Yeah.
But even if we only find, it's true, but even if we only find like 2 per day,
okay.
That'll still be amazing. And we could find 50 per day. I think the 10 per day is actually like a neutral guess. It's neither optimistic nor pessimistic. Another topic. Over the last 50 years, pulsar science has been a really fertile and interesting area of astronomy. The first observational evidence for gravitational waves came from watching pulsar orbits decay. Pulsar science can claim the first detection of extrasolar planets, although that seems to have been sort of a fluke. It's hard to know what to make of that. Many of our most precise tests of general relativity have come from pulsars and all sorts of new rich astrophysics, such as the existence of magnetars. About 200,000 pulsars have been found in astronomy so far, but the total number is larger by like a factor of 100, so there are many new discoveries to be made. And we estimate that if we could optimally search a month of CHIME data, we should find something like 4,500 new pulsars, which would be totally amazing from a single telescope.
Kendrick, do you have for the pulsar search, is there a period window that you can search for in pulsars? Outside of it, you wouldn't see them with CHIME?
Oh, I think it would be hard for us to look for search for millisecond pulsars. So far, I've only been thinking about, I've been restricting scope of the search to slow pulsars. We're also at relatively low frequencies, so I would say the main like corner of parameter space that is difficult for us is if there's a lot of scattering or if ISM propagation effects are important, that'll smear out the pulse at low frequency and reduce our signal chain. Other than that, I don't think we have many constraints on what we can find.
So the total population is 10 to the 5, but what's the fraction of that that has pulses pointing to us?
Oh, I believe, my understanding is that this number includes the beaming factor. This is the number of observable pulsar. And finally, CHIME can try to time known pulsars, and the big milestone here would be to detect gravity waves. Just like LIGO can detect gravity waves by comparing light travel times between arms of an interferometer. If you're timing all the pulsars in the galaxy and a gravity wave goes through this picture, it will advance timings in some along lines of sight to some pulsars and delay timings on the others. You can infer the existence of gravity waves on like light year time scales.
Question. So you're saying you cannot find new millisecond pulsars, but you can time the already known?
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. It's just too the volume of data that you have to save if you want to search later for millisecond pulsars is really large. CHIME is not in an ideal frequency range to time pulsars. And for this reason, our forecasts in this area are not as impressive as the other three that I previously mentioned. CHIME observes at low frequencies where ISM propagation effects do significantly broaden pulsars and reduce timing precision. However, in combination with existing measurements at higher frequencies, such as the nanograv measurements, A lot of the residual timing noise in nanograv is due to uncertainty in ISM-related nuisance parameters. And by chimes measurement of the same pulsars at low frequencies can help pin down those nuisance parameters and improve the nanograv timings. And our official phrasing is that we estimate that chime can improve timings for most nanograv pulsars by a factor of two. In summary, and all of these forecasts are really derived from chime's huge mapping speed. Chime has amazing forecasts in multiple areas in cosmology and several areas of astrophysics. It's relatively inexpensive and small on the scale of new telescopes nowadays, and any one of these amazing forecasts would fully justify a much larger project. Most excitingly, I don't really see any obstacle, if chime works like we think it will, to scaling up by like a factor of 10 or 100 in mapping speed. If you were to add cylinders to chime, the mapping speed goes as the number of cylinders cubed. So just making it three times as big, we'd have 10 times the mapping speed. This might seem a little too good to be true, and you might be wondering whether there's a catch. And there is. In the slide, I like the word challenge better than catch, which is that here's why this is so hard. So far, I've been concentrating on this column of the table, mapping speed, which is statistical power in principle under the assumption of unlimited computing power. But the data volume that the instrument generates is proportional to this column, the number of beams. So if you want high mapping speed, you can either increase A or increase N. And increasing A is very expensive, and increasing N, like we do in chime, is very cheap. You move difficulty from hardware to software. In order to make chime work, we have to scale up the computational cost of radio astronomy, not by like a factor of two, which would be a matter of optimizing some code, but by like a factor of 100, which sounds kind of crazy. So this really has required us to revisit the algorithmic foundations of radio astronomy and really try to improve things by orders of magnitude. And I think it was not obvious when we started that this was going to work. Radio astronomy, by reputation, is one of the most computationally intensive fields of astronomy. Scaling up by a factor of 100 is really hard. If I'd realized this at the beginning, I might have chickened out on doing this project, but glad I didn't. So I want to try to quantify these challenges and explain a little bit how chime computes. So the first thing that happens in the chime computing is that the analog signals from the telescope are digitized and channelized in some FPGA boards, some custom field programmable gate arrays. And the data rate of the experiment at this point is 800 gigabytes per second, or 70 petabytes per day. I saw a hand go. Sometimes I like to express this in astronomers' units by saying that this is 5,000 copies of the LSST telescope. LSST is often considered to be the quintessential example of big data in astronomy at 15 terabytes per day. But data rates in radio astronomy are orders of magnitude larger than other areas of astronomy. Next up is the correlator, which is a 1024 GPU machine. That is really a huge supercomputer. Collectively, Chime is one of the largest supercomputers in Canada. And what the correlator is doing a huge calculation, and what it's actually computing is the two-point correlation function on a per nanosecond basis between every pair of antennas in the instrument. So in every nanosecond and for every pair of antennas, that correlation is stored in a GPU register somewhere in this machine. And that is a huge computation, and it's way too much data to disperse over the network. But anything that you want to know can be derived from that data product. So instead of, if you want to do something new, like looking for FRBs, instead of building a new telescope, you just build a new cluster of computers, plug it into the correlator, and ask the correlator for a new data product. That's what I mean by software telescope. So for example, if you're interested in pulsar timing, the top branch here, then what you would want to know is you'd have some known pulsars, locations of known pulsars on the sky. And at each of those locations, you would want as much information as possible. That is, the full electric field with polarization at the sky location sampled every nanosecond, or around 10 to the 9 samples per second. If you're interested in FRBs, then you need less information per beam. You might need, say, 10,000 frequency channels and one sample per millisecond, or about 10 to the 7 samples per second. So you're doing some averaging, and you also average over polarization to get intensity. That's less data per beam, and so you can ask for it at more sky locations. We can ask for it at all 1,024 sky locations. If you're doing cosmology, then you are interested in very slow timescales. You can ask the correlator for data every 10 seconds. And you ask for the maximum amount of information possible, which is the full two-point covariance matrix between the antennas, a 16 gigabyte snapshot of the covariance matrix. That's what's called, or the visibility matrix is the radio astronomy term for it, every 10 seconds. And so the correlator is spitting out each of these data products into more supercomputers. The FRB search backend, for example, is a 2560 core cluster. That's a real supercomputer that do their own processing. And they can stop processing when the data has been reduced to a small enough volume that we can ship it offsite to traditional computing facilities. For example, the FRB search backend is really a triggering backend that when it thinks it may have found an FRB, it triggers the dump of the data to disk, and then we can send that offsite for arbitrary post-processing. So all of this real-time processing is just to reduce the data down to a manageable volume. So in summary, the Chime hardware is incredibly powerful, but requires very hard computing or algorithmic problems to be solved. Here's my list according to my tastes in what's interesting and my subjective ranking from easiest to hardest. First, the problem of finding FRBs in real time. Second, the problem of removing RFI, or radio frequency interference, that is human-made radio transmissions from the data. A cell phone a kilometer from the telescope is brighter than the sun in radio, and there are lots of cell phones around, so this is a huge problem. Third, the problem of finding pulsars in real time. And fourth, cosmology, where there's a hard data analysis problem of separating the cosmological signal from other things like galactic foregrounds. Even though my long-term interest is really in number four, I've mainly been working on one and two, and to a certain extent, three. Mostly, I think, because I like to solve problems from easiest to hardest. I just thought it made sense to try to find FRBs, if that's really easier, first, and then do cosmology. And second reason is that the way the cosmology analysis works, you just save data to disk for many years, and it's easy to figure out what to save. And then you develop all your algorithms so that they post-process that data. The other searches are all real-time, meaning if you don't have a complete pipeline working, then you have to throw away data. So that's another practical reason why I thought it made more sense to start with the real-time parts of the search. So in the remaining part of the...
I don't quite understand why they're different in that sense. Surely you could just store all the real-time FRB data just as well, look at it later.
No, because it's like a petabyte per day.
Just can't store it.
Oh, yeah, we can only...
More than the cosmological data.
Way more, yeah. We can only ever save maybe 1/1000th of our data to disk for the FRB search. Okay. So in the rest of the talk, I'm going to be talking about work that we've been doing here at Perimeter on these problems, starting with the FRB search. So to set up the FRB search problem, there is an array of intensity data that's arriving incrementally at an FRB search node with 16,000 frequency channels and one time sample every millisecond. And there are 1,000 of these beams arriving all the time, so it's a lot of data. And you're searching for a faint pulse with a frequency to the -2 dispersion that is buried in the noise so that you have to sum all the samples in the array across the trajectory. The dispersion delay, or the number of time samples that's spanned here, can be tens of thousands. So that's just a lot of different sums to do, and it's an expensive search. Our algorithm is a recursive tree algorithm that works as follows. The first step is to regrid and change variables on the y-axis to frequency to the -2 so that the tracks look like straight lines. And we're formulating the problem as summing over all straight lines in a continuously arriving array. Let me say in advance that what we're actually going to do is approximate those straight lines by jagged samples that are built up recursively. And to describe how that works in this, let me take an 8-channel example. I'm going to group the 8 channels into 4 pairs. And in each pair, I'll take all blue sums, which are vertical, and all red sums, which are diagonally related to each other, and put all the blue sums in this tree and all the red sums in this tree, or in this child. The color coding is supposed to tell you how each array element in a child corresponds to 2 or more elements in the parent. And then I'll just do exactly the same operation recursively on the subarrays, on the children, to get grandchildren and great-grandchildren and so on. And you'll see how that naturally builds up the straight lines. If I do exactly the same thing to the children, now this array element in the grandchild corresponds to the sum of two things in the child, or four things in the root. And if I do it one more time to get great-grandchildren, you can see that I've built up all possible, a complete set of straight line trajectories in the parent. That's the basic idea. And this is an efficient thing to do because, for example, the yellow track and the orange track share, you know, this, they share part of the computation. And that's only computed once in a grandchild array. It's not computed from scratch when you compute the yellow track versus the orange track. More quantitatively, it's easy to see that the tree algorithm has computational cost tf log f, where t is the number of time samples, f is the number of frequency channels. Whereas a direct approach, just summing over all of these lines, looping over all possible lines and doing the sum, would have cost tf squared. So in time, where f is like 10 to the 4, this tree algorithm would appear to be 1,000 times faster than a simple direct search. However, in radio astronomy, this type of algorithm is not very popular. A direct search is more widely used for two reasons. First, this tree algorithm tends to badly underperform its big O analysis due to memory bandwidth bottlenecks. And second, tree D dispersion is making some approximations, like approximating straight lines by jagged trajectories. And it's not clear whether that loses a lot of signal to noise, how statistically optimal it is. So we solved both of these problems here at PI in the last couple of years. And so I'll talk about our solutions, starting with memory bandwidth and code optimization issues. So the next few slides, next four slides, are for people who like writing code. I like writing code. So here's some ordinary C++ code to compute the transpose of an n by n matrix. This looks pretty simple, and it doesn't really seem like it could probably be optimized in any way. But here's a version that is four times faster. And what's going on in this code is that each of these C++ functions is really a assembly language intrinsic that's mapping one-to-one onto an assembly language instruction. And what this code is doing is it's reading the matrix out in 8x8 submatrices and doing the transpose entirely in registers. In 2012, Intel introduced the AVX registers that can hold 8 single precision floats in one register. So you can read an 8x8 matrix entirely into registers. And then there are these permutation operations that swap 8 things around at once. So you can get 8 for the price of 1, so to speak. That's the fundamental reason why it's faster. You have to figure out how to factor this size 64 permutation as a bunch of basis permutations that are defined in the assembly language instruction set. And that is hard for compilers to do, but easy for humans, actually, if you read about how it works. So the compiler cannot figure out how to get from here to here, but a human can. So we got really experienced at this type of hand vectorization being the human compiler. And we frequently get like factors of a few speed up. I would not normally recommend it, right? Normally, I would prefer to let the computer spend four times more time than spend more of my time. But we're already building like the biggest supercomputer in Canada, and we just can't make it four times bigger. So this type of optimization is really important for us. The most important speed up that we've gotten in this tree D dispersion is actually a cache optimization. The way that I described it, the algorithm, you are reading a big array and separating it into children. You do one pass to get the child arrays and then another pass to get the grandchild arrays and so on. And if implemented that way, it would require the entire array to be exchanged between the CPU cache and main memory DRAM in every iteration of the tree. So like for a depth 15 tree, which is what we use in Chime, you would be reading data back and forth between memory and the cache 15 times. And so our big optimization was to find a way of making this only go through the cache twice. And in longer talks that I give that are just about FRB search, I present some slides that show how it works. But it takes a few slides, and I thought it was too much. Roughly the idea is to sort of coalesce these different levels of the tree and reorder operations to make it more cache friendly. And you can do like 7 or 8 iterations of the tree in one pass through cache. Yeah.
Is all this playing around why you chose 1,024 antennas?
Oh, no, no. This was all figured out much later.
Is it a computer scientist who chose the number?
We knew it should be a power of 2.
You wanted to be a power of 2.
Yeah. Okay. And so this gives us a huge speed up and also helps parallelize to multi-core machines, since all cores share bandwidth to L3 cache. Another interesting property of this blocked algorithm is that it's incremental. So even for an FRB that spans many tens of thousands of time samples, search can trigger on the event within a few, for an FRB that lasts, say, 30 seconds, search can trigger on the FRB in a few seconds. And that's actually really important and convenient for several reasons. First, we would like in the future to issue real-time alerts and to the astronomy community, and it would be nice to have those have low latency. But another thing that's really, really important is that the raw electric field data is coming in, and it stops here. And the GPU sends out intensity beams, which have less information to the FRB search backend. And if the FRB search backend detects the event in time, it can send a message back to the correlator where the electric fields are being buffered and save the electric field data, the raw electric field data from which the intensities are derived. And there's more information in that data. It's too much to send over the network, which is why we have to do this two-stage trigger thing. For example, the polarization of the electric field lets you infer the magnetic field near the FRB, which is really physically interesting. We can also do things like post-process the electric field data to get higher angular resolution, locate the FRB more precisely. So this was not something we originally set out to do, but it just kind of came out naturally, and it helps us increase the science scope of the search. Finally, when I give talks to radio astronomers, maybe it's not necessary at PI, I have to talk about statistical optimality, since the question always comes up as to whether the search is really statistically optimal, for example, because these jagged tracks are not perfect straight lines. And so I got asked this question so many times that I have eventually answered it in the form of a theorem. We have a theorem that our algorithm is optimal. It recovers 100% of the signal to noise in the appropriate limit, where appropriate limit means that the number of channels in the tree, these channels that are equally spaced in frequency to the -2, is large. The original the input data to the search, which is evenly spaced in frequency, is assigned to those channels by smearing a data channel across all of the tree channels that it occupies. And finally, if the tree is run at slightly higher time resolution by like a factor of 2 or 4 than the input data by duplicating samples when the tree is initially populated. Under those assumptions, it's a theorem that the tree is the search algorithm is optimal. And here are some Monte Carlo simulations showing that as we increase these internal upsampling parameters, we recover arbitrarily close to 100% of the signal to noise. The parameters that we use in Chime are sort of represented by the red dots here, or our search is usually 80 or 90% optimal. So in summary, we really crushed this problem. We have an FRB search algorithm, which is provably near optimal, runs in real time with few second latency, and is much faster than other search software. Here are some bullet points to explain how much faster. It turns out that the Chime FRB search, when it starts running, will be the largest FRB search in the world in data volume by a factor of 1,700. The second largest search, the 36B ASCAP survey, is 1,700 times less data. With our algorithm, if I understand the parameters of the search correctly, we could process this entire survey in half of a CPU core, like same cost as running this on the laptop as running this PowerPoint presentation. This level of optimization would obviously be overkill for this survey, but it's not overkill for time. We really need it to run this fast.
Is ASCAP running now?
It is, yeah. Okay, so, and none of this is published yet, but it will be soon.
So are you going to offer them help to analyze their data to ASCAP?
we do plan to make our code public. So, you know, anyone, including these guys, would be welcome to use it. Okay, next I'll talk a little behind where I wanted to be in time, but I'll talk a bit about, as much as I can, about these next two topics. First, I want to talk about the problem of removing RFI from the data, which is something that we've also been doing here at PI. For an FRB or a Pulsar search, the largest problem by far is removing human-made radio transmissions from the data. And I really underestimated when we started how difficult this problem would be and how much time we ended up spending on it. Our main tool for mitigating the RFI, and I'll show up a plot in a second, is just masking the data in the time frequency plane before we run an FRB search or a Pulsar search. The RFI tends to live in like boxes in the intensity time plane. Because when someone makes a phone call, then the phone is broadcasting for a limited range of frequency channels for a limited amount of time. So the way our code works is it in real time tries to construct a mask that masks out boxes in the intensity time plane. This is, of course, a huge long-standing problem in radio astronomy that every experiment has to grapple with. And there are standard packages, but they don't suffice for time for several reasons. One is that they're just too slow. Our data volume is just much larger than everybody else. The latency also tends to be too high. The existing packages tend to assume that you just collect a bunch of data and save it to disk and then analyze data in big chunks. We need to run in real time with low latency. And finally, and most importantly, the false positive rate is generally too high for a search like Chime. A good false positive rate for a traditional search would be a few events per beam per hour. And that's fine if you're searching a modest amount of data where you save to disk, you can have a bunch of false positives and just have humans sort it out later. But if we were taking this approach with Chime, we would get, since we have 1,000 beams, we would get 10 to the 5 candidate events per day, and that's too many for humans to post-process. Here's some Chime data. Here's our whole pipeline in action. The top plot, now this looks a lot better on my screen than it does here. So you're going to have to take my word for it when I tell you about some of the things that you're supposed to see in this plot.
We can ask the operator to. Margaret, can you turn the lights down?
Oh, okay, okay. Oh, great. That's better. Okay. So, the top plot is some raw Chime data from an engineering run in December. This is intensity, and this is time. The black stripes are missing or masked data. So there are a lot of black stripes here because a lot of the correlator nodes were down during this run, and so there's some missing frequency channels. And you can see some structure in this plot. Like, there's a lot of power up here. And if you can look closely, you can see it's not thermal noise. There's some structure to it. And there's also some frequencies down here where there's a lot of power. And that is all RFI. Like, this band is the LTE cell phone band. If we were to run this raw data through our pipeline, any Pulsar or FRB in the data would be totally swamped by RFI. This is the data after our whole pipeline for real-time RFI masking has run. And you can see that it's just it's masked like this cell phone band. There's some frequencies that are masked entirely. There's some times that it didn't like, so it cut out all of the data at a few times. There's some sort of irregularity going on here where there were some channels that it disliked some of the time, but it thought we were okay some of the time. When we run this masked data through our dedispersion pipeline, this is the output of the dedispersion transform, indexed now by time on one axis and dispersion delay on the other axis. What you see here is not an FRB or a bunch of FRBs, but a pulsar. There's a bunch of repeating pulses, all with the same dispersion delay, regularly spaced in time. I chose this example so there would be a false positive in the plot. This guy here is not an FRB, but it's a false positive from RFI because something went slightly wrong in our masking process. So occasionally, there aren't many of these, as you'll see in a second, but occasionally we do need a human or some further form of processing to distinguish false positives from RFI.
What pulsar is that?
This is the BO329 pulsar, which is the brightest pulsar in the sky. Okay. So here's this is from the same engineering run in December. This is what I call our RFI victory plot. This is time during a two-day acquisition, and this is for a single beam that was averaged over the whole sky, not a focused beam, but the so-called incoherent beam that averages sensitivity over the whole primary beam. During this two-day run, what's plotted here is just the statistical significance in sigmas of the most significant pulse that the pipeline saw. During this engineering run, we had a tiny fraction of our target sensitivity, like a few percent. So the only pulsars that we had the sensitivity to see were BO329 and the Crab Nebula, which go through the beam twice. And everything else here, like this little spike and this little spike, is an RFI artifact. A normal, good, excellent false positive rate would be a few per hour. And here we're only getting a few in 2 days. So we're actually improving things quite a lot over the state of the art. Furthermore, even our false positives are not that bad. Like if we were to set the cutoff at like 13 sigma, which is not too far, we'd like to set it at like 10 sigma, then there would be no false positives. So this was a real triumph for the RFI pipeline. I want to say a little bit about how our pipeline actually works. So we noticed at the beginning of this project that if you compare different RFI removal software packages, they all kind of combine a common set of building blocks in a different order or in a different strategy. So we tried to design software around this observation. We have some software building blocks that we call transforms, which operate on the data plus an associated mask. And each transform just does one little micro operation, like clipping outliers in intensity based on some smoothing scale and with some threshold. Because our speed requirements are so demanding, we can write this small set of building blocks in assembly language, like I was talking about before. But our software framework allows us to chain them together and run experiments from high-level languages like Python so that anyone in the collaboration can play with this. Over time, we experimented on a lot of archival data and came up with a chain. What we currently use is a chain of like 100 of these transforms. And this effort was to find this was led by my student Masood, who's here in the audience. The reason why we do so well is that tend to use more transforms. I think we use more transforms than most of the packages. And we're much more iterative, and we can dig much deeper into the RFI. This slide does not do justice to the amount of human time, more specifically poor Masood's time, that was required to experiment with the data and different tuning of parameters and orderings of these transforms to come up with a sequence like this. And it's probably telescope dependent. Like there's no reason to think that a different project in a different RFI environment would use the same chain. So something that we'd like to do all we do is put out fires in the Chime software. But once the search is running a little more stably, we'd like to get back to the open question in the field of whether a general solution to the RFI removal problem exists. Every project tends to write new software from scratch. But we speculate that we sort of have half of a general solution in that you just develop some universal toolkit of transforms or low-level building blocks. We've mostly done that. And then what we next want to do is automate the process of getting this. Find some sort of learning algorithm so that instead of investing a lot of human time, you would just let the computer run for a long time on some archival set of data and construct a set of transforms that works for a particular RFI environment. I think there's a good chance that this can work. And if it would work, well, this is not a glamorous problem. But it's a problem of immense practical importance. Every radio telescope, every experiment spends a huge amount of time wrestling with this problem. And if you had some automated solution, then it's hard to think of anything that you could do that would have more like general practical importance to the field. This is the problem that you have to solve before you can do anything else, like look for FRBs.
Do you think machine learning can help with that?
Yeah, I totally imagine that a machine learning algorithm would be the sort of thing that you'd want to look at to find something.
How do you, is there a worry that a machine learning algorithm would
learn to filter out real signals? How does it would learn to filter out interesting signals along with the uninteresting ones? How does it know to distinguish?
Oh yeah, so if you wanted to be careful, you could have your training set include some like simulated FRBs. You just simulate an FRB on top of real data that didn't contain one, and then just add a constraint that it's not allowed to classify that as RFID. Or pulsars. But you could worry that maybe...
Unknown signals.
Yeah, yeah, unknown interesting things.
So,
Kendrick,
on that, the importance of the software kind of involvement in China, if you don't have a pipeline for a surprise, you wouldn't see it, right?
That is a big problem. In fact, if you look at the original first discovery of an FRB, it was sitting in archival data for years before anyone noticed, because no one knew that you could have an isolated pulse at, you know, very high dispersion measure in a radio telescope.
Right, but at least the archival data was available here because you cannot handle such a huge amount of data in the beginning. You might be completely lost.
That is true, yeah. The problem is certainly worse when you're, you have to throw away 99.9% of your data, and you can only trigger when the computer sees something interesting. I'm not really sure what to do about that. It's hard. It's a real problem, and it's hard to think of a general solution.
I guess the solution is make predictions fast enough before the data is taken, so that it can then work.
Yeah. I mean, if you had something specific that you wanted to look for, like a pulse with the frequency to the -3 dispersion, we could set up a real-time trigger to look for it. But what you do about interesting things that you don't know that you should be looking for in advance, that's a real problem with this big data astrophysics. Okay. In the meantime, so this is like future things we're thinking about. In the meantime, the RFI removal is working extremely well. And in conjunction, this work on RFI removal that we did, combined with the work on the FRB search algorithm that we did, suffice to start an FRB search. And so we are currently building an FRB search backend, the Chime collaboration, to run the search. The construction of the physical cluster is scheduled to be finished in late May, so we can hopefully start it soon. And it's very highly anticipated. Like, here's a New Year's article in Nature News with some interesting things to expect for science in 2018. And we were number one on the list. Since I only have 3 minutes left, I'm actually just...
It's late, so if you want to take some more, take...
Well, I probably need about 10 minutes to talk about pulsar shift. Yeah, okay. All right, cool. So since everyone's staying for an extra 10 minutes, I'll talk a little bit about pulsar search, which is something that we've started thinking about. So the Chime, we would like to do a real-time pulsar search. The Chime pulsar search is where the FRB search was a few years ago. We have some amazing forecasts on paper. Practically no software written, and the big challenges are in front of us. I wrote like a methods paper just proposing some new algorithms and like analyzing them mostly at pencil and paper level that I'm going to just talk about a little bit for a few slides to give a sense for the sorts of things that we're thinking about. Hopefully over the summer, we'll start the heavy lifting of writing a lot of software and seeing whether we can meet our forecast of finding something like 4,500 new pulsars. And the plan is to add a fourth computing backend. Right now we have three backends, but we plan to build a fourth one to search for a pulsar. Here's the simplest instance of the pulsar search problem. Imagine that I have a perfectly periodic pulsar. Now a real pulsar, if it was like in a binary system, would Doppler shift as it went around the binary. So you would see this pulse frequency speed up and slow down with time. Or the motion of the Earth has a similar effect. But just to start with the simplest case, suppose that we're searching for a perfectly periodic train of pulses in a noisy data set. And I've written the signal as a function rho applied to a sinusoid. So rho here is a function that takes a unit complex number and returns a real number, which is the height of the pulse. The optimal search algorithm here would be to just loop over all of the parameters in the model. Here the pulse model has two parameters, a pulse frequency and a periodic phase parameter. And for each set of trial parameters, just sum over the samples in the noisy time stream, weighted by the strength of the expected signal. So I wrote that weight as an integral of the continuous profile over the range of times spanned by the time symbol. Now that is, as phrased, that is an optimal algorithm that looks too slow. If you were to literally implement this by outer looping over these parameters and doing this sum. But you could ask whether there's a fast algorithm for doing this. And this is one of the results in this paper. And I think it is helpful to interpret this operation as an integral transform that takes a function of one variable, the time stream. Well, I discretized it and wrote it as a sum instead of an integral, but 1D input and outputs a function of two variables. And just ask whether there are like some FFT tricks for doing this transform, this integral transform, efficiently. Here's a fast way to do it. And what I like about the slide, the reason that I wanted to show this slide is that, so this is a new result, this fast algorithm for doing that transform, that you would think that pulsar search being a 40-year-old subject, that it would be beaten to death, and there would be no way to find four lines of algebra that would be new and interesting and have a large impact. But empirically, that's not true. There's tons of room for improvement. And that's why we're doing so well on Chime, I think, and why this is a very interesting field of research to get into right now. So just to walk through it briefly, you know, I started with the definition of the transform that I'm trying to do. And then in every step here, I just did some operation, like expanding the profile out in Fourier modes, or doing the time integral, reversing the order of summation. And it is possible to write the result in a way where if you just evaluate the sums from right to left, you get a fast algorithm. This innermost sum over k is just the Fourier transform of the input time stream. That can be done very quickly with the FFT algorithm. Then there's a step where I wrote the multiplying in this factor as a step where you take this function of one variable and interpolate it to get a function of two variables. And then there's just an outer sum, which is also a FFT and a periodic coordinate. That's the fast algorithm. To go, just to show one more example. So the sorts of things that we're thinking about are more like mathematical improvements than software improvements. There are a lot of different aspects to this problem, and this is actually kind of a long paper, but I just want to show one more example besides the one that I just showed, which is the case where the pulses are not constant in frequency, but the acceleration or the derivative of this frequency is constant. So now there's a three-parameter space of pulse models with an acceleration parameter in the space. This is the most common type of pulsar search that is done in real data. If a pulsar astronomer tells you that they ran a pulsar search, they probably mean this search. And this leads to the same sort of, you know, integral transform, just with an alpha t squared here. If you think about how to do that transform, the fastest way of doing it is with a tree algorithm, which has some similarity with our FRB search algorithm, where what I want to do is divide the time interval in two. Suppose by recursion that this transform has been evaluated on each half of the time stream. Then because the sum here is a sum over time samples, it satisfies the recursion relation where the value of e hat on the whole time stream is the sum of an e hat value from the first half plus the sum of an e hat value in the second half. This e hat should have a 2 subscript on it. With some correspondence between the, you know, alpha, omega, and phi here and the parameters, the acceleration, frequency, and phase parameters in the two halves. So there's a recursion relation where you populate a tree from the bottom up, and I would populate this array via some recursion relation where each sample here is the sum of one sample taken from the left child plus one sample taken from the right child. As you go up the tree, the number of trial frequencies is growing by a factor of 2 in each step, and the number of trial accelerations is growing by, it turns out, a factor of 4. So the root of the tree for a deep search dominates. In the leaves of the tree, where the subtime streams are not long enough to see the acceleration, you would use the constant frequency algorithm from a few slides ago. So this algorithm is very efficient, and these searches are usually done using a different algorithm called power spectrum folding that I won't describe in detail, except to say that this tree algorithm, just for the most common pulsar search that anyone ever does, is both parametrically faster, you know, in the big O sense, And it's also statistically optimal, unlike what's currently done. Now one can go on from here. I talked about the case of a constant period search or a constant acceleration search. And this gets much, much hairier. You can add more derivatives. You can add the parameters of a binary pulsar and so on. But rather than, it would be easy to give a whole talk about pulsar search. But I think I just wanted to give a couple of examples that are representative of the type of ideas that we are thinking about. I want to summarize by saying that, you know, it looks plausible that this algorithmic toolkit is sufficient to scale to a chime-sized data volume, and that we will be able to do a chime pulsar search. But we need to do a lot more work to find out. Okay, I just want to conclude with a few slides. Going back to this list of problems from earlier in the talk, we've solved the first two problems on the list. We have some you know, good concrete ideas for how to solve the third one, but it will take some time. I still claim that my long-term interest in this project is topic number four, but I still think it makes sense to do the problems in this order. So I'm hoping to get to this soon. Problems one and two took about a year each to solve. I mean, this is definite, this is tough stuff. For some problems, like finding FRBs, it really is true that you can take this table at face value. As far as I can tell, Chime will be the most powerful telescope on this list for finding FRBs. And it is also by far the cheapest. It's about 1% of the cost of these other instruments. In addition, you know, I don't see any obstacle to Chime is highly scalable. It's still relatively low cost. To scaling Chime up to instruments that could have, say, 10 or 100 times the mapping speed. So I would like to propose that Chime is interesting, not just as a telescope, but as the beginning of an era in radio astronomy towards large N and clever algorithms. And I think it's sort of obvious that large N has to win in the end just because of Moore's law. Every few years, computers get a little faster, and that tips the optimization of a radio telescope a little bit in the direction of large N. Although just describing it as Moore's law does not do justice to the huge speedups that we've been able to get by revisiting the algorithms and revisiting the way the software is written. That's where we're getting most of our speed up right now, not just waiting for Moore's law to catch up with our ambitions. And new experiments are appearing that are inspired by the Chime design. For example, we're involved in a project called HIRAX, which is a South African sister project to Chime that's a few years later in timeline. That's very similar. The main differences are that it's an array of, the decision was made to use an array of dishes rather than a few cylinders. HIREX has not been built yet. This is an artist's drawing, not a photograph. It has four times more collecting area than Chime. It will also probably, I'm not sure, but I think, end up being cheaper, just because even though it's more collecting area, computers have gotten a little cheaper in the last few years. One thing that's super interesting about HIREX is that it will have outrigger telescopes from the very beginning. We plan to scatter a few subscale with maybe 8 or 16 dishes, a few subscale telescopes all over southern Africa. And that lets you, for a brief period, have incredibly high angular resolution. The angular resolution of an interferometer is the wavelength of the light over the inter-antenna spacing, which is like thousands of kilometers here. So when an FRB goes off, for example, we can localize the FRB to, say, a microarcsecond. So you know exactly which galaxy it went off in, and even what part of the galaxy. And this will enable a lot of interesting science. And finally, it's in the southern hemisphere, which the southern hemisphere, you see a lot more of the galactic plane, and so it will potentially find more pulsars, for example. A point that I really want to stress is that we can reuse most of the software that we've written for Chime in HIREX. So even though it took us, you know, years to solve these problems, it won't take us years to adapt the same software for HIREX. That's why I think this is so interesting to work on radio astronomy right now. The work that we're doing is establishing the computational foundations for new telescopes such as HIREX. So I think it is likely, at least I don't see any showstopper obstacle, to radio astronomy scaling up by orders of magnitude, say a factor of 100, in the near future. The discovery space, if we can do this, is huge. In cosmology, we hope to make the 21-centimeter fluctuations into like a 3D super CMB. This plot is just comparing the volume that you can potentially access with 21-centimeter observations to the volume that galaxy surveys currently access. And then here on the edges, we have the 2D CMB, whose volume is zero, so it's 2D. Futuristically, so this is a futuristic program, but it is potentially the most powerful way to measure many cosmological parameters. In pulsar science, there are still 99% of the pulsars in the galaxy remaining to be found, which will enable new tests of GR. There are big milestones coming up, like detection of gravity waves through pulsar timing, and undoubtedly lots of new astrophysics to discover. Fast radio bursts are something new and really interesting. We don't know what they are, so the first question, this is the first question to answer. Depending on what they turn out to be, they may have applications, like cosmological applications. We really don't know what kind of follow-up science will questions we'll want to answer once we know what they are. I also think it's worth saying that fast radio bursts are a surprise that no one expected. And as we improve sensitivity by orders of magnitude, we may encounter new surprises. So the potential discovery space here is really, really huge and interesting. When I started this project, I just had been doing CMB for a long time, and I thought it would be fun to do some 21 centimeter cosmology. But I think this project is much more interesting than that. It's part of the first step in a big program to do radio astronomy orders of magnitude better. And it will be really interesting to see what we find in the next few years. Thanks.
Let's start with student questions, if there are any. Okay, let's open it up to all questions.
To what extent do you have to, when you say you build the supercomputers for these three or four applications, to what extent do you have to literally build them yourself and design them to optimize them?
We do in Chime. We just order the parts, and we put the computers together, and this is all done in McGill, actually.
Okay.
And then they're shipped out to the site, and some of us, like a student Masood.
So to what extent are you involved in the architecture of those supercomputers? Designing, very low-level software.
So in the case of the FRB search, most of the software was written here. And so we really kind of chose what hardware would be most useful. We
so
more or less designed
that. After thinking about that.
It's definitely best to write the software first.
Right.
And then do,
find the right architecture to operate it.
Yeah, yeah. But there are a lot of decisions, like trade-offs between CPUs and GPUs, that I didn't talk about. Another big challenge is the cooling. All these systems have to be water-cooled, since they have to be sealed up in like an airtight metal box to avoid. Computers emit a lot of radio waves, so operating a supercomputer next to a radio telescope is just like having a spotlight, right? And so we have to run a long pipe in and have a lot of plumbing inside the computer room, which is generally a really bad idea.
Yeah.
That has been one of the most difficult parts of the project, and there was a period of a few months where all of the telecons were like physicists pretending to be plumbers, trying to figure out how to get air bubbles out of pumps.
Do you work closely with the company, the computer the chip manufacturers, or?
Actually, in the case of the plumbing, we gave up on doing it ourselves, and we now outsource that to a private company. But the computers we really build ourselves. We choose the parts and assemble them.
Do you need to have the computers next to the telescope?
Because there's so much data that it would just be infeasible to. You'd have to use really specialized network equipment, like optical fiber or something, to look at them very far away. The fundamental reason the computers have to be so close to the telescope is that you just can't run like ordinary Ethernet cable over long distance. Even as close as they are, too, there's like hundreds of kilometers of cables in the experiment.
So since you're slicing kind of the same data in so many different ways, do you have to worry about correlations in the, I guess this is probably most relevant for the cosmological application, but correlations in kind of your different beams, because they're all kind of assembled.
Absolutely. That's right. One thing that happens is that these software beams have side lobes. So if there's a bright source that you want to mask in part of the sky, then there's some leakage into the other beams that you need to. Masking doesn't really mean masking. It means some subtraction process. I would say, is one of the largest complications for doing the cosmology. It makes the cosmological data analysis into a big linear algebra problem, which is not as diagonal as the cartoons might suggest.
Do you do any hardware detection of the RFI? Do you try to subtract it out directly at all?
No, that's something that we've talked about, but we haven't actually tried doing it yet.
And is there a clear reason for that? Is it that the software is just much more optimal, or is it that you haven't tried yet?
No, it's an interesting thing that we would like to try. You can get like an RFI. Most of the RFI probably, that's a very good question. Most of the RFI probably comes down the axis of the cylinder, is emitted on the horizon and comes down the axis of the cylinder. So you could, for example, have like an RFI telescope that's like sits here and points this way, feed it into the correlator and try to use that to build a template for the RFI that you could subtract off. The radio telescopes do this sort of thing. This is one trick in the RFI toolkit, but we haven't actually had a chance to try it yet. It may help.
So I think you said because of the frequencies that Chime is sensitive to, it's limited to a redshift of about 2.5 or something?
That's right.
Yet you had something that had 9. I mean, so what is potentially the largest redshift that 21 centimeters could access?
Oh yeah, that will probably, so the lower you make the frequency band, the farthest, the lower frequency you go to, the further out you can see. The problem is that the foregrounds of our galaxy, mostly synchrotron emission due to electrons circulating in the magnetic field of our galaxy, have a spectrum which rises quickly at low frequencies, like frequency to the minus 2.5 roughly. So that acts as both a source of thermal noise and also makes the problem of separating the cosmological signals from the foregrounds harder. So I would sort of guess, this is really a rough guessing game, but I would sort of guess the practical limit might be like redshift 10 or 15 or so. There is like a hard limit at a redshift of around 50 due to the, which is the plasma frequency of the ionosphere where the ionosphere becomes opaque.
So for Earth,
but the practical limit's probably.
Earth-based one.
Oh yeah, that's true, if you're Earth-based.
On the moon, something. Yeah.
That idea has been floated. Yeah, putting a 21 centimeter experiment on the moon. If you really need to see past redshift 50, then your only course of action would be to commit like the entire resources of the Earth to building a huge interferometer on the moon.
The RFI problem is another.
That's true. The RFI problem gets solved too. Two problems at once.
We have a question. In the beginning of your talk, we were talking about the area and the number of channels. I didn't quite understand what the obstacle would be to taking an existing telescope like FAST and kind of retrofitting it with an array of detectors and then doing the software analysis on that. Why is that infeasible?
So in FAST, only a limited number of beams are actually in focus.
Can't you put an array of detectors and by software change the sort of emulate a rotation of the dish? As I understood what you were talking about, you sort of emulate rotations of the disk at the software level.
Why can
that not be done with existing infrastructure of old telescopes? Why did we have to sort of build a new telescope to do that?
I suppose it is true that the telescope the optics of the telescope are invertible, so that if I have rays coming in from every possible direction, and then I were to put a whole plane of antennas here, there's some transformation that inverts the optics of the telescope. But then there would be no point in the telescope. You may as well just put the antennas on the ground. The only thing the telescope does for you is for a few directions, you know, the arrays come together and you only need one antenna. And that number is, like, there would be maybe 10 antennas worth of directions that are reasonably in focus for a normal telescope.
So what sets the angular resolution of Chime?
Oh, yeah, it's just the wavelength of the light divided by the length of the longest baseline or the inter-antenna separation. So our longest baseline is 80 meters times square root 2, and the wavelength of the...
If you have longer beams, you would get better angular resolutions.
Absolutely, that's right.
I see.
That's right.
So this HiRex plus Adrigus will be substantially better than Chime, having higher resolution pictures of the FRBs.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right. So HiRex, because, so the Chime baselines are of order 100 meters.
Right.
And the HiRex baselines are of order 1,000 kilometers. So it's like 10 to the 4 times better. But the thing is that we're not continually correlating the outriggers and the core.
They connect them if they're thousands of kilometers.
Yeah, right. So we couldn't run cables and continuously correlate them.
No.
So what you have to do is trigger. These have to be set up to trigger to save data to disk at the same time. And then we bring the disks together and correlate offline. That's why we could only, like when an FRB goes off, we can save the data for the duration of the FRB and then do the correlation, you know, a week later after everything gets shipped by FedEx, after all the hard drives get shipped, and localize the FRB to a microarc second. But we can't like continuously correlate these instruments and determine the location of every radial point source in the sky to a microarc second or anything like that.
Just a correction, your map doesn't show you Rwanda, and that one is quite well ahead.
Oh, that's true, yeah, yeah. So since making this map, Rwanda has emerged as a candidate location. So it should be up
far
to...
along now.
That's, oh yeah, okay, okay.
Equipment's gonna be ordered very soon.
I didn't know that. Learning something about HiRex and stuff.
So do you know, like, since you haven't really described foreground cleaning, do you think you can get useful information up to a reg of 2.5, or is it kind of unknown up to where, like, how well foreground cleaning will
work? I think it's a very hard problem because I think that in principle, the cosmology foreground separation problem, the separation of foregrounds from the cosmological signal, would be fairly tractable for a perfectly characterized instrument. If we knew in Chime the response of every antenna to every pixel in the sky at every frequency, then it is just a, in principle, just can be solved, a problem that's solvable by brute force linear algebra. It's sort of painful to implement and it requires a supercomputer, but it's solvable. The challenge is that the Chime beams are fairly non-ideal and complicated. Things like the radiation doesn't just bounce off the cylinder and come up to the antenna, it can reflect off the feed line. So things like standing waves in the cylinders are important. So trying to solve for the beams of the telescope and also cable delays, responsive antennas and so on, at the same time that you solve the cosmological separation problem is really hard. That's a problem that's why I put the cosmology number 4 on the list, why I say it's the most difficult. That problem is really hard, and we don't know how to do it yet. We're going to have to try.
So a big part of it will be characterizing the telescope.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
What's the strategy? How do you go about doing that?
Oh, yeah, we do things like, take a lot of measurements, like when a bright point source goes through the beam, we get a measurement of the response of the telescope at that particular, along the trajectory of the source at that particular declination. It would be possible to give like a whole 1 hour talk on Chime calibration. We do things like fly drones over the telescope. The problem with the point source is that you have to wait for the sky to provide it. But if you have a drone, you can continuously fly it over the telescope. You can make the drone's antenna pseudo-random, so you have the same pseudo-random number generator in the correlator and correlate the... What's that?
At all frequencies and all positions.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. That's right. It's all frequency dependent.
So if I understood, you chose cylinders because that allows you to simultaneously look at a lot of different directions and use the software to distinguish them. But then, if that's true, why did HiRex use dishes and not cylinders?
Taking
advantage of that.
Yeah, the question of whether to use cylinders or dishes. The only real disadvantage I see to the dishes, the cylinder is kind of convenient in that the primary beam is a stripe.
Right.
And so every 24 hours, that stripe rotates over the whole sky. In HiRex, the primary beam would be like a large spot
right. That's
maybe 5 degrees in radius. And so over the course of a day, it sweeps out like an annulus.
Right.
So the plan in HiRex is to, Now, if you could put motors on these dishes,
yes.
Then you could, you know, change the elevation every day. But part of the reason why these instruments are so inexpensive is that we don't pay for motors. So in Hyrax, the compromise has been to develop like a, you know, non-motorized passive elevation changing mechanism where you pull a pin, and then some Hyrax collaboration members, like some students, would go out. Yeah, like once a month or so, they have to go through each of these 1,024 telescopes, pull the pin, and change the orientation. A lot of engineering went into this so that like a couple of people can change the elevation in maybe like 10 minutes per dish, which means it's not too crazy. I think in Chime, we just didn't want to deal with that. But in Hyrax, the decision was made to use dishes. And dishes do have some advantages. Like there's less crosstalk. The dish is sort of shielding antennas so they can't see each other. Whereas in Chime, the antennas are like 30 centimeters apart on a feed line. And so there's some noise crosstalk. The noise is correlated between antennas. So we'll see which is better. From my point of view, analyzing the data, Hyrax is likely to be the more convenient design. But then again, I'm not the person that has to go out there and pull pins and rotate dishes. I'm biased. Yes, yes.
Why is the thing arranged in a kind of a Cartesian pattern? Why not use a hexagonal pattern?
A hexagon would also work. So the regularity is important for a technical reason that a regular array has a redundancy. Where you know a given pair of antennas would have some separation, some baseline, which is repeated many times, shared by many pairs of antennas. And that redundancy is related to, allows you to make some computational speedups when you form the beams. You can use some FFT tricks to do it faster. But within that general framework, you have some flexibility, like us having a Cartesian array, which is redundant, would work, and a hexagonal array would also work. And you could use similar FFT tricks. In fact, we may end up using a hexagon. I'm not sure which way we'll eventually decide.
Okay, well, before we thank Kendrick one more time, we'll just remind you we have snacks down in the bistro where you can ask Kendrick more questions.
Thanks, everyone.